Thank you for downloading this podcast from policyreview.tv.
Good it is. So welcome to this afternoon's session. This is a masterclass about care pathway innovation. My name is Michael Wilson and I lead the London Health Programmes team. For those who are not familiar with London Health Programmes, we are a group of people who work on behalf of the PCTs to do work where it's agreed that doing it once for London makes sense. And our business includes health intelligence, service transformation and pathway redesign, and commissioning support and development. So that's the kinds of things that we do. So I'm going to be really interested to hear this afternoon's presentations. Three very different topics, which I think will make for a very interesting compare and contrast when we come to the questions sessions at the end. It seems to me that this business of innovation is absolutely pertinent at the moment, in the sense that the challenges which we face, which have been rehearsed at length this morning, so the demographic challenge, the financial challenge, the challenge to improve quality, those challenges can't be met by just doing more of the same and trying harder. We actually need to do things differently, and the things we need to do differently are our core business of how we provide care to patients. We can't just change how the back office functions and slice 10% off their costs. So I think the kinds of things that our speakers are going to be describing for us are absolutely at the heart of what we need to be paying attention to now. I've just got a couple of administrative things to remind you of. They'll be very familiar. So mobile phones to silent, please. Information, so the kind of presentations are going to be available from midday tomorrow. And at the end of the session, there are more refreshments back in the main hall. Speakers, take note of this bit. So after I've stopped speaking, you've each got 15 minutes to deliver your presentation. If it looks like you're going on too long, I'll stop you, and that will make sure that we've got some good time at the end for questions and discussion. And now, without further ado, I'm going to introduce to you Dr. Sylvia Tang, who is going to talk to us about work that's being done on mental health care to change the pathway to mean that it's not necessary for mental health patients to spend as much time in an inpatient bed, and that alternative therapies and solutions are available that will support that. Dr. Tang.
Thank you very much. I'm going to talk to you about a piece of work that we probably started in about 2007 in Camden and Islington. We have always been thought to have quite a lot of beds. I think that the benchmarking probably isn't completely accurate and doesn't completely compare apples with apples. But certainly we took it on the chin. We've got a lot of beds. There's a QIP program. We need to do something about this. And I'm just going to take you through a little bit of history for those that aren't so familiar with mental health, and then talk a bit about the work that we've been doing. So this is where, in the early 90s, where we were. In fact, I used to do an outpatient clinic at this hospital. I don't know if you recognise it. It's now Luxury Apartments, Free and Barnet Hospital in North London. It was famous for its longest corridor. And that's where a lot of my peers trained, where we did work, primarily inpatient-based work. And then we had the National Service Framework for Mental Health. We were very fortunate in lots of income. These were the good times when there was investment in new service, new innovations in services. In the late 1990s, we had multi-professional community mental health teams, integrated teams. We were fortunate that our teams were integrated with social care. And in fact, we became a social care trust when they started. Community mental health teams do assessments, care coordination, care management, treatment interventions, psychological interventions. So a whole lot of things going on in those. And they're locally based. So our trust had 11, but you know, a variety of different sort of models around the country. In 1999, we developed something called an assertive outreach team. Assertive outreach teams were for revolving door patients who disengage, don't take their medication, very risky, coming into hospital quite a lot. And it was thought that a different integrated model of care would be good, that by visiting them at home, administering medication, we might prevent admissions. And in fact, the REACT study, which was a randomised controlled trial, showed that we didn't actually do anything to their admissions. But there was very high satisfaction from the model. So, in fact, engagement was much better. But, in fact, we didn't seem to change their health outcomes. Then crisis teams were started. So home treatment teams for people who might otherwise come into hospital. So we, in fact, had one of the first models of crisis teams in the country. And we've written books, as you can see there, and conducted randomised control trials and qualitative trials. So the impact of these services is that they the high satisfaction of service users and impact on informal admissions, so people that aren't detained under the Mental Health Act. And currently, we have about 30% of our admissions are under the Mental Health Act. But funnily enough, when you look at the people in hospital, there's 70% of the people are actually under the Mental Health Act, and it's partly because people who come in who are informal are maybe getting discharged more quickly, or actually they change their minds once they've got there and say, I don't want to be here. So it seems to have an impact on that particular cohort. Other developments are early intervention services for early psychosis, which we're still doing research on, and I think the research from other countries suggests that it's successful in preventing a progression of illness, but in this country we're yet to evaluate that. And IAPT, which those of you that were here this morning heard Lord Layard talking about IAPT, so you'll be familiar with the so psychological interventions in practices locally. It's at 100% in Islington, where we are today, but it's very high in the local area. So what do we do next? NSF came to an end. We've got all these new models. They don't seem to be particularly lined up with each other. They're not, you know, they've been evaluated, some to a success or some aren't, and they're pretty mandated to some degree at that point. But certainly I think that we have a responsibility to coordinate how these services work together. Having more services means you have more interface issues and all those sorts of things, sort of battles between teams as to who meets which criteria and so forth. So we implemented a few different models, which we were then free to do. So something called recovery centres were a modernised day hospital. So day hospitals where the average length of stay could be possibly a decade in some places. We modernised a very intensive day model for average of 12 week with a choice of therapies. And as you can see, one of the things about consolidating your services is that you get very nice environments, so we were able to concentrate on the environments. And we also implemented something called crisis beds, so we had different varieties of crisis beds as alternatives to hospital. And the quote that you can see there is from someone that had used it. The early indication is that they do take people that would otherwise have gone to hospital. So 60% have psychotic diagnoses, which means that they have a serious mental illness. 78% had been to hospital in the previous 2 years, so we are capturing that population. And we're actually showing improvements in health outcomes and high satisfaction again. So what did we do? We've got all these new services. Some of them are alternatives to hospitals. Some of them are community-based models for later down the pathway. We thought we ought to do good old process mapping and look at where the blocks were. At the point we did this in 2007, we had 16 delayed transfers of care, so one ward's worth of delayed transfers. About 2 years before that, we probably had two wards worth of patients out in private sector. So we were getting the right direction. We're still using all our beds. We had five sites at that point. We're only a two-borough trust, so that's really quite a lot of hospitals to be running. Two of the things that we identified in terms of blockages, one was blockages with housing. So we looked at the social care end of the spectrum, and we looked at where we could facilitate some and resolve some of those blockages. So where people in supported housing were in hospital, perhaps going to stay in hospital for a while, to unblock that and to give up their tenancy so that other people could go in on the proviso that once they were ready, they could have those. And that seemed to address this 16 delayed transfers of care. We now have minimal numbers. We have one or two at any one time, if that. And then we set up local vigilance systems and a process of escalation. A lot of time was being spent on interface issues and battling between clinicians or teams about what should happen. So we arranged for local escalation processes to happen so that the patient could get their needs met. And we thought, we have one model of inpatient ward. We had inpatient assessment wards, acute wards, and we had rehab wards or longer stay wards. And we thought that, I'm an inpatient consultant, so my experience is that if you're expecting an admission, if it's someone that you know, that's all well and good, you feel quite happy to manage them, you know what the care plan is. If you get someone that's just jumped off the train at St Pancras, who you don't know, who's a heavy drinker, who's homeless, it's always slightly irritating. You don't really know what to, you weren't expecting them, you don't know what to do. But actually, what we found was that they need a completely different type of care, and they need completely different mindset in terms of addressing their problems, their homelessness, their, you know, not being on benefits necessarily, or getting back to their local area. So we set up a new model of assessment ward, where if it's your job to deal with this cohort of people, actually you don't mind doing it, because you can actually, that's what you're expecting to do every day. And we have put in daily ward rounds, which doesn't sound very revolutionary in an acute hospital, but the normal psychiatric ward will have once or twice a week ward rounds. So having a consultant ward round on a daily basis is actually quite different. But it does mean that you can discharge people 24 hours after they're admitted, or 12 hours after they're admitted, which we could never do before. And people might have gained a week's worth of bed days before we even address their needs. So moving towards a seven-day-a-week hospital, and also getting rid of some of the age boundaries around care. So this artificial sort of, at age 65, you go to a completely different set of teams and much more evaluating needs. So the care pathway is following our process mapping and all these teams lining up. So there's a process of referral, crisis team assessment, and or A&E assessment, depending where they've pitched up. We try to avoid A&E assessments, but we can't help people walking in. And then there's a choice of home treatment or crisis house, or the recovery centres, which I showed you. And you can probably work out that if you had a crisis bed for a short time and an intensive daytime programme, you've actually got 24-hour care without needing a hospital. But if the risks are too high, we still need hospital beds, and we accept that hospital beds will always be needed. It's just what quantum. The other bit that's changed is whilst you're in hospital, you don't have to be fully better to leave hospital, which traditionally you would always have had to be fully better to leave. And now you can be offered home treatment or a crisis house at whichever point that that's safe to do so. So it has involved quite a change in mindset. So public consultation, you can't get away from it. Having set up our services, we did two public consultations, one in 2007 and one last year. 2007, we were quite anxious about what we were doing. Beds, you know, we're quite dependent on them. So we consulted on closing 25 beds and moving to 4 sites from our 5 sites. But then by the time it got to 2010, having successfully done that, we were consulting on 95 bed reductions and consolidating onto 2 acute sites. Couldn't believe that we thought 25 was so difficult to achieve before, but I think we've got the bug, I think, and as we worked on the pathway more and more and the vigilance on the interface issues, we were finding that we had 65 to 85 empty beds every day, and therefore we needed to do something about this. The savings were, as I say there, 2.7 million in the first round, and we predict 4 to 5 million in this round of reductions, so not insignificant money, but a lot of quality benefits, so quality to the buildings. If we've only running two hospitals, we can really keep those in very good condition. We can have ensuite bedrooms. We can really work on the sort of therapies that are delivered there and have a consolidation of that structure. So as I say, the benefits for service users are they have more choice. Before, you didn't have a choice. You either needed somewhere more than being at home, and therefore it had to be hospital, or you were well enough to be at home. So now you have a choice of environments to be treated. We've done randomised controlled trials. We know that there's higher satisfaction with the new models. We've got better environments, better choice of therapy, and better resource at each site. And, of course, we're using our financial resources more effectively. So where are we up to? So I've said that this goes into the future. We've, as I said, minimal delayed transfers of care. We've successfully kept those really down to a minimum. And on the benchmarking, it somehow looks like we're lower than anywhere else in the country. So we just think that possibly that's not right, but it may be. We've got 58 beds closed. 14 more are closing in December. And we've got 30 beds empty. We've closed one site in July, and our second site is due to close in January 2012. We're consulting on moving two long-term rehab wards, or houses, from another site onto one of these sites so that we will have all our inpatient provisions on two sites, which is quite exciting. So I'm just going to leave you just with a list of benefits for you to look at while I move. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tang. So our second presentation this afternoon is Dr. Mike Gill, who is coming to talk to us about some work that's been done in Newham, and in particular looking at how to make sure that the administrative resource is aligned with what clinicians are trying to achieve and how that can give benefits to the patient pathway.
Right. So, welcome. And I'm just going to take you through a little journey we've had. And to say we've completed the journey would be a falsehood. But I can give you some of the journey and why we embarked on it. And it's about we're using a patient pathway coordinator model and transformation at Newham. Now, for you, anyone who doesn't know where Newham is, because most people don't, it's the home of the Olympics. It's where West Ham play football. It's got the third biggest shopping centre in Europe, in the UK now. So it's got its own airport. So it is quite an interesting place. It's also got, probably the most multicultural borough in the UK. Wonderful place to work. So if anyone offers you a job in Newham, come to Newham. But we had a sort of problem in terms of where we were in going through last year. So we're what I would call a medium to small sized acute trust with a portfolio that's difficult in the current climate, where it's mainly acute and maternity. Newham actually being one of the capitals of childbirth of the UK. We were looking at the prospect of significant income loss, partly through reasonable changes to the patient pathway. And doing the same wasn't an option. So you can, there was various turnarounds we'd been through. Everyone's been through a turnaround, haven't they? He had a turnaround where we'd taken what I call the low-hanging fruit. So there wasn't much low-hanging fruit around. So we had a burning platform. We were trying to use that as an opportunity. We'd also got some benchmarking that suggested we'd created a monster of our own making. We'd created lots of admin and clerical support and management support. And I think that's the sort of story of the what I call the years of plenty, as we enter the years of austerity, that when you wanted to do something, you built another team. You took in another group of people and ended up with multiple layers and actually some complexity. But mainly we wanted to improve clinical care. In a transformation we'd done several years ago, we had outsourced transcription services. And the promise of the outsourcing of transcription services is that we were going to redesign the support to clinicians and the patient. We got our savings and we stopped. And if I had any regret, we should have continued. But having hit the bottom line, the feeling was, whew, whew. And this is tough stuff. So when I describe this journey, it's not easy. So when we're talking about the change from the top down, that doesn't mean we implemented the change from the top down. We started the change at the top. So to exemplify we were going to get leaner, we trimmed our executive team by 3 posts at outset. Separate consultation, separate process that made it clear that it wasn't going to be done to people. We were doing this across the board. We were reviewing exactly how we were. The principle around it is that the corporate services should be leaner, more flexible and aligned to clinical services. And the big corporate was to be shrunk. And we were to go back to first principles. What we do is treat patients. What we manage is patient pathways. What we need to do is make sure our admin and clerical management support is dedicated to that process. That's what we do. That's what we do as a hospital. So we decided we needed to wrap the admin and clerical resources around the clinical teams and deliver a reduction through that with an ANC and management resource. And how do you achieve a reduction? Well, there are areas of duplications, workarounds, rework. So I have a classic example of the good old days. Before the years of plenty, I would have been, when I used to do a clinic, my secretary used to know how I worked. She could take a call from one of my patients. She would know that I would see anyone in my clinic if they needed to be. It could be from the patient or the route to the patient. She would immediately say to the patient, I'll slot you into an extra on his clinic, he will see you, and then she'd leave a note for me. And that would be it. Job done. Well, we got to a position where the process would take someone having to phone up a booking clerk who would then email me to release the clinic because the clinic was overbooked, to go back to the booking clerk, who'd then go back to my secretary to say you could phone the patient. By that time, the patient said, I've had enough, I'll take them to A&E because they'll get seen within 4 hours. So you can see how, you know, these are the sorts of systems and processes. So we were going to get rid of those duplications, those workarounds, and rework the whole system. So we tried to, the admin activities undertaken by the most appropriate person, the person close enough to the patient, reduce the resource and the intensive policing and validation role. The clinical services were going to take greater ownership. So though we've transformed the admin and clerical and management support, this is really saying to clinicians and their teams, you are now responsible. You have your team, they're with you, you become the responsible person. No excuses anymore. You can't say, oh, they didn't do this, oh, your management are always in my way, as you often hear carpenter clinicians do. Now, you've got your team, you fix it. Your problem, you've got the power to fix it, you've got the responsibility. So the clinical lead's got overall responsibility for the clinical team. The pod is not the iPod, it's point of delivery, it's our mnemonic for point of delivery. So it's all wrapped around point of delivery teams. So clinical teams, point of delivery teams and corporate functions operating in a standard streamlined processes. We had to really define those standard processes. Now in those pods, we have multi-skilled staff. We're bringing staff from different backgrounds. So we've said that transcription services had moved into another provider. So we were moving people like medical secretaries alongside booking clerks. So we're bringing a whole group of different people together. And doctors had to get to the point. So one of the forever meetings that I would have is, what's only my secretary? Well, actually, your secretary is now one of your patient pathway coordinators. And we worked out that there's around one patient pathway coordinator for every whole time equivalent consultant. It doesn't mean they've always got the same one working with all their patients, but they've only probably got one or two that they're working very closely with, so they're very aligned to. This is the vision overlaying this, is there will be 3 business units with them having the clinical pods, the point of delivery units underneath. The business units would have all the resources to manage their business, including governance, finance, information, all out there with them, stripped out of the central corporate structures, straight out where you need it. The clinical pods have managed to manage their own resources, so they're now in charge. They have to come and stand and be accountable for how they're managing those resources. Lead pipe clinicians working as a team, and the clinicians can then manage the clinical pathway with these, what the PPCs, which are the patient pathway coordinators, these new admin and clerical roles. And everyone else supports them, including streamlined corporate functions. So one of the problems we have at the moment, so we're still on our journey, 6 months into the transformation, is that we are now working pretty hard to keep reminding the business units they are responsible for governance, they are responsible for NICE guidance, they are responsible for complaints, they are responsible for those responses getting out on time. The corporate function's not going to do it for them. They're not going to be disabled from it now. They've got to do it. And it's a journey which we're still on, because the corporate function doesn't exist. So you'll see a slide later that explains that. So this is the model, conventional model. Most places are working to this, allows you to do service line reporting and everything else. But the bottom layer here is with these patient pathway team leaders working closely with a clinical leader, lead clinician, along with patient pathway coordinators and some trainees going in there as well. The thing about this is, if you are going to change, this is a big bang. It's not much thing. But there's an extensive process that underpins this. And if anything, I would commend you the fact that this takes time. So you had to go through a staff engagement consultation, extensive comms, working very closely with HR. You needed to develop working patterns, workflows, standard operating procedures, the pathways they were going to work to. All of this stuff, really, really important, and that takes some time. You had to revamp your IT and telecoms. Simple stuff you forget is that now you've moved them around a bit, they've got to have the single phone line that people can get to, so you can manage all of that. And there's significant training and development in new roles, how people would... Some people were already familiar with some of these roles, some of them weren't. Risk management performance matrix, we needed to be clear that once we went to this, because we were going in a big bang approach, we weren't making things worse. We're a hospital that is lean, but it must be safe. Physical locations, this is important. We were making sure the clinical teams and their pods and their patient pathway coordinators are close together. They can talk to each other, the consultant can talk to each other, they are one unit. That causes a few problems. You know, we've got pretty cramped hospitals sometimes getting them in, and there was a bit of trading that had to be done. Again, not easy. I'm not moving to my office, you know, the usual territory, but we've managed to get through that. Some pod development workshops and a Big Bang deployment, the Big Bang deployment, which we did in April of this year. How do we know we got it right? Well, we think we should have more streamlined pathways. We shouldn't have lots of handoffs for patients, and we reflect that by what our patients will be telling us. We want no delays for patients and staff. We want seamless, standardised processes. Patients being seen right place, right time, right person. We want happier patients who value the hospital, happier staff who are proud to work. And a three-month stock takes, we've got genuine positive feedback. But the fat lady hasn't sung. This is a work in progress. So I'm not going to say, it's all done, finished, signed off. But interestingly, having gone through that in a lot of initial reticence, we are getting gradually that wave of actually this starts to make sense. And as I said, our biggest challenge at the moment is working through the position of the corporate. So if you see what's actually happened here, if the slide... The light blue line is the post that we deleted. The dark blue is the new post we created. And the net posts reductions are in white. You can see most of the posts we've deleted. Where we've changed the system, we've changed the system in operations, we've created those business units, and we've deleted few posts there. But they are now working with a lean corporate. They have to come up and do it, because the corporate posts have been stripped out. Where the work posts in the corporate, they're out to support the business units. The overall position is that, as you can see, is the net post lost on the right. Obviously, we didn't create any more directors. So I think we've been on a journey, which we're still on. it's allowed us to, we were stuck. We couldn't take resource out by just taking a few posts there. We would have fallen over. But on reflection, what we had created is a monster of our own making, which had become too, actually unwieldy, in fact, as I sort of described with my story about the patient wanting an appointment. We've now fixed that. We now need to fix the business units being properly responsible for the governance and the way they run their own systems. We need to make sure they don't behave like silos, but they still operate within the whole. And as some people know, because we're still struggling, because we are an emergency-led maternity hospital, effectively, we have to find a partner. And what we think is we are at last taking... the only reason why someone would take us on as a partner is we might have some intellectual property that might help them get through the years of austerity going forward, because we haven't got a business that they would want to buy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So our final presentation this afternoon is Dr. Bill Lynn, who's going to talk to us about some work that's being done to address the high levels of TB in London.
Yeah, I'll just get that loaded off. I'm afraid I was out of the country until yesterday, so I didn't have a chance to get this loaded up before. Before we go, that's just following on from what Mike said. I come from Ealing Hospital, which can rival Newham for the most culturally diverse area, and as you see when we come through on this in terms of some of the pictures, also for some of the highest rates of tuberculosis. I've had a sort of slightly varied career over the last year or so, and I've also been acting chief executive for a period of time, and we're going through our partner discussions at the moment, and in a very similar scenario scenario to yourself. Just having a look to see if this will open up here. Very helpfully does not appear to be recognising my stick at the moment, but we'll see if that happens. Anyway, just as a preface before that comes up, I'm an infectious diseases consultant, worked at Ealing since 95, and if anybody had asked me, it's very usual, I think it's even better, I think we'll close that. Many apologies for this. And see, for some reason, it doesn't seem to be recognising my stick. Let's just have a look in a different way, see if it'll come up that way. It should just come straight up. But if we look at TB, if someone asked me even a year ago as to whether or not I was managing TB correctly, I'd say yes, we can all manage TB. It's very straightforward. There's nice guidelines, there's international guidelines, World Health Organization guidelines. TB is managed by a mixture of respiratory consultants and infectious diseases physicians around the country, and generally speaking, we feel that we manage it quite well. If then somebody says, and how would you reduce the rates of TB in London, you then go, oh, well, that's very difficult, because actually we import most of it every year. And if this will open up, I'll show you some figures and statistics that will go along that. And so therefore, you've got the challenge of how do you reduce TB across the whole system in London. And again, if somebody had taken that forward a number of years ago, when there was more money around, that actually becomes an easier thing to begin to address and an easier thing to deliver. So where we are at the moment is we believe we understand what the problem for TB in London is. We've got a proposal as to how we could begin to address that problem.
Doesn't want to read it.
Doesn't want to work. There we go. So many apologies for that. So going to the figures, and I think the figures become reasonably shocking. So in 2010, there were just over 3,000 cases, new cases of active tuberculosis in TB. That's the highest of any major capital city in Western Europe. And I've mentioned the other things we've gone so far. Just want to say a little bit about TB. It's a communicable disease. It's human only. You can get it in cattle, but you know that's not a major source of human spread. It's person to person, transmitted by inhalation. And this is the important thing, is that acute infection can either lead to pulmonary disease or extrapulmonary disease. That makes you sick. But most people resolve their infection. They then have what we call latent infection. In other words, it's hidden away, it's in the body. It may reactivate later in life. And that's the biggest source of new cases in London. About 80 to 85% of cases are reactivation of latent disease in people who, most importantly, have acquired disease overseas, which means we can do as well as we can in detecting and treating new cases of TB. We won't actually reduce it. Consequences may be progressive pulmonary disease or extrapulmonary disease leading to death, or more importantly, I think, from the economic perspective in London, tremendous amount of morbidity, tremendous amount of long-term disability, and a tremendous amount of lost earnings and lost time. If you look at that from just a clinical point of view, I show you a number of very quick cases, all of whom we've looked after. This patient here has got a big abscess in their chest, started with TB in Afghanistan, poorly treated there, came to the UK, two courses of treatment in the UK, ended up, major operation in London Teaching Hospital, a year in hospital. This patient, long-term neurological damage from here. This patient, paraplegic from spinal tuberculosis. And this patient, big abscess on the front of his chest, and that took 3 months off work before he was able to get back. So it's a tremendous impact here in a number of communities from that. Treatment consists of complex TB drugs for at least 6 months with side effects. And treatment success depends on very, very high rates of adherence to treatment. Now, if you couple that with the fact that we know that TB targets vulnerable groups, newly immigrated people into the country, people with mental health problems, social problems, drug and alcohol problems, you can see that it's actually quite difficult to maintain these people through. Treatment completion is essential, and that requires a complex multidisciplinary approach. If that doesn't work and you develop complex TB, so that's the sort of case I was showing you just now, or drug-resistant TB or drug toxicity, this requires prolonged treatment with even more drugs for an even longer period of time. And the treatment message is get it right the first time and get the treatment to follow the patient wherever the patient is going so that you get consistent and secure treatment with that. And just to give you one anecdote from that point of view, we recently had directly observed therapy in a patient who was on a maintenance methadone program, and the success to getting him sorted out was persuading the methadone dispensing pharmacist to give him his TB treatment with his methadone 3 times a week. That's the sort of approach that you need to do. Latent TB, as I mentioned before, we can detect latent TB, and treatment of that can then reduce the risk of later reactivation. The problem is, at the moment, is we don't have agreed screening protocols for this across London to detect those patients, agreed treatment protocols to decide who to treat, and most importantly, we don't have a mechanism at the moment to say how would we incentivise that and how would we pay for that across primary and secondary care, which is our biggest challenge going forward. Just to nail the BCG debate for you, BCG will not reduce the rate of tuberculosis. It's not a tremendously good vaccine. It doesn't stop us getting infected with TB. And as I said, most of the people developing TB in London have caught it in their countries of origin. What it does do is it protects against disseminated TB and death, and that's why we have a neonatal BCG vaccination program in areas of high risk. It stops children from dying of TB, but it will not control TB for us. Sadly, if you've had your BCG, you should still go on and get it later on. A little bit of epidemiology for you, that's a sort of typical global map. And if you look at this sort of level of TB here, out of 100 to 300 cases, 100,000 population, you come up with places like the Indian subcontinent, etc. And if you glance at this, 0 to 24 is the UK. So you'd think that was nice, until you start to look at what's happened in London. And these are the overall figures for London, that shows that over the last sort of 10 to 20 years, the level of TB in the UK has remained relatively low, but in London has been climbing inexorably. And we're now the only capital city in Europe that has done that over that period of time. Just to show you the London figures in relation to the rest of the country, you don't need to be a statistician to interpret that graph. And the vast majority of these cases are people who have acquired disease overseas. So if you look at this here, this percentage up here, 83% have acquired their tuberculosis overseas. The trouble is they don't have that clinically when they present and they're admitted to the country. So port of entry screening will not pick up and will not deal with those patients. As I say, if you look at the green line here is London, Paris has dropped, Rotterdam has dropped. If we go into London as a whole, our good friends at Newham, here, Rival, where I work out, here on the Hounslow-Ealing border, and Brent as the highest prevalence areas. And in those areas, you're talking about rates of TB which are equivalent to parts of the Indian subcontinent, 100 to 150 cases of TB per 100,000 population, and it mirrors deprivation indices within London. Now, a lot of has been made of comparing us to New York. New York had a rising TB problem. I was working in the United States at this time, remember this well, rising TB problem, and then a dramatic fall in TB cases. And how did they do that? They did it by investing huge amounts of money. The problem in the United States was actually that patients who had TB tend to be in vulnerable groups, and the American healthcare system was not good at looking after vulnerable groups. And therefore, they had to put a huge infrastructure in place to do that. We're different to that because we've got that infrastructure in place already. The problem is, how do we actually deliver investment to reduce the TB cases? It was easier in New York because about 80% of TB in New York was caught in New York. So therefore, if you focus on disease detection and treatment, you will prevent ongoing treatment. So the aims of the London TB plan, sort of challenge came through from London Healthcare to London Health Programmes, was to reduce TB. And I think we've really split that now into two thoughts. One is to provide the best evidence-based care for people in London, and secondly is to reduce the number of TB cases. Now, this is an aspiration, because to reduce the number of new cases of TB will require investment in a programme to detect and treat those latent cases. And at the moment, we've not got to the stage where we can say exactly how that is going to be done. We pull together different sort of initiatives into one strategy for London. The case of change has been developed by the TB community widely. There's been a number of engagement events going through that, involvement of the Health Protection Agency and TB networks. And I have to say I'm indebted to Sean Farron and the TB group for pulling this together. I've joined this programme relatively recently. But it is, I think, a well-based and broad-based plan. As I said, there's been an extensive engagement period, which I won't go into detail for today. The messages really from this, as I said before, 80% of active TB cases are from latent disease. It's more prevalent in social risk groups, drug and alcohol users, homelessness, prisoners, people with mental health issues, and I would say particularly also in that vulnerable patient population within the first 3 to 5 years after entering the country, often moving around multiple boroughs, often with lots of comorbidity in terms of both physical and social problems. There's no systematic screening in place. And treatment for prophylaxis for people who you do screen and find have got disease is unpleasant, lengthy and difficult to deliver. As a result of that, we have too many people presenting late, developing complications, death, onward transmission to other people and morbidity, as we said before. It's really difficult to find out how much money is spent on TB across London, but the estimated current spend is about £25 million. But if you look at the case, an uncomplicated case will cost about £1,100 in direct cross treatment. A complicated case, drug resistance, bit of short hospital stay, up to about £10,000. And the highly drug resistant cases, like the sort of patient I said earlier on, drug resistant TB, needed cardiothoracic surgery, could cost up to £100,000. So we believe if we can target and improve the treatment of TB, we will reduce the rates of drug-resistant TB, improve outcomes for patients, reduce complications, and that should save money. The problem is actually getting a handle on those figures to work out how much to do going further forward. Current service provision is of 5 TB networks across London, with variability in the commissioning standards, variability in service planning, protocols, delivery and education. We've got nice guidance. It's very good, only it doesn't answer a single difficult and complicated problem about how to manage patients with TB. Does all of the sensible stuff well. There's very poor awareness of TB amongst non-specialist health professionals, which means we get a lot of late presentation. And there's had a variability in service resources, and the service resources do not align with TB rates. This just gives you one idea of the variability across London. This is borough-based treatment completion rates. So as I said earlier on, we would say we're good at treating TB. We actually have boroughs who have a lower than 80% completion rate. World Health Organization modelling and guidelines is you need to hit at least 85% to prevent onward transmission and reducing TB rates. So we've got tremendous variability in TB care across London. So our case for change highlights and addresses the risks for London, and we can provide those, the care for change or the operating or our draft model of care for people if they are interested. And that unless we do something to look at this systematically across London, particularly in the new commissioning environment, we risk fragmentation in services, a deterioration in quality of care for patients, and increased rates of active, latent and drug-resistant TB, which will lead to greater cost. So we've got a model of care. This is a draft model of care at the moment. It's not approved yet by NHS London, aiming at the start of that model of care actually to strengthen commissioning. I mean, this is almost sort of poacher-turned-gamekeeper sort of type thing. This is whereas, you know, as somebody who delivers TB care, I don't want the commissioners to come along and beat me up. But actually, unless they come along and beat me up, we won't deliver good care. To address that variability of service provision, and then the difficult bit is about improving detection and diagnosis. BCG vaccination rates, getting them up is straightforward, I think, in terms of the commissioning approach. The proposal is to have an overarching London TB Commissioning Board with a coordinated multi-agency approach, and this will engage social services, will engage partners in the voluntary sector and other areas with the aims and objectives there, and then deliver this through local TB delivery boards. There'll be five TB delivery boards working through a lead provider in each sector and network to formalise patient care into different levels that reflect current informal care pathways. So the idea is to have specialist, generalist and sort of overall type cares across these three levels and to ensure that London protocols are implemented and outcome indicators are achieved through a process of cohort review. And I'm going into that in detail if people want me to afterwards, but this is a sort of TB world equivalent of peer review. It's to look at a cohort of patients on a regular basis and look in detail to say, did they meet all the care standards that have been set down? This has already been piloted in north central London and is beginning to be rolled out across the area. The idea of a sort of standard level 3, level 2, level 1 type provision is that this level here is what we expect all health providers to do. This is level is what we expect people who are treating TB to do, and this is the specialist support that those people treating TB need in order to deliver it. Now, if you did that in cancer, you'd centralise all the care. That's what cancer has done. So if you look at these levels 1, 2, 3, up at level 3, it's sort of managing things like multi-drug-resistant TB, paediatric TB, spinal TB, TB in special groups. But what we recognise, if you say you're going to centralise those patients into specialist centres, that doesn't work because you'll lose a lot of your patients along the way. So it's about how do these level 3 centres, which will be one per sector, probably one per sector, might be two per sector, will actually then support the people on the ground delivering care, and then how all of this supports the people who are out there seeing lots and lots of patients in the front line, in mental health, social services, primary care, and other community setting to find the patients who've got active and latent disease and make those better. We want to improve detection and diagnosis, which I mentioned before. So that's through targeted education. And what we realise as a TB community, it's a bit like we've got in other areas. We've got a big drive to improve HIV awareness over the last few years. In HIV medicine, which I do quite a lot, we kept all the testing to ourselves until recently. We need everybody testing for HIV. It's the same with TB. We need everybody aware of TB. We need the social workers to know and understand what are the trigger symptoms. We need people in primary care, community care, mental health, etc. to know that. So there's a big educational drive that's required there. And then we need to work on our pan-London protocols for active and latent tuberculosis. And BCG vaccination I don't need to go into in detail. So implementation, I'm just wrapping up now. Immediately we believe we're in a position already where we can start the process of awareness raising, begin the educational protocols, develop the standard protocols for risk assessment, directly as of therapy and the cohort review. Going forward, we'll establish the TB Commissioning and Delivery Board to this across London, service reconfiguration, maintain what's called a find and treat service, and our latent and TB and detection and treatment service and workforce delivery development. I think the challenge for us, and where I'd like some input from the audience here, is how we can put into place a London-wide framework in the context of the new commissioning landscape as that comes up. So I'll stop at that point in time. Thank you
very much, Bill. So even though it's going to feel like there are more people at the front than in the audience, I'm still going to do the traditional thing and invite the speakers to come to the front so that we can do some questions.
and I quite liked the point that Bill left us at, which was that in addition to questions from the audience to the panel, it looks to me like there's also the potential for the panel to be asking the audience questions, and that would be a good and proper interchange. So who has questions?
I have two questions for the last speaker and the graphics you displayed for London are quite shocking. Indeed, it's obvious that's the situation. And I just wondered on the awareness campaign, how are you going to, perhaps not alarm the population, but nevertheless shock them into a reaction? Because TB is associated with something that happened years ago, and it's something of the mist of time. I work in a mental health trust where we have met it, and we've had near misses, where really bad practice in isolation could have led to more serious cases. So how are you going to maximise the impact of your graphics to illustrate to people that this is a serious issue? And the comment on London having incidents or indices, a typical developing country, is very worrying and should be worrying for us all.
I'm sure. I mean, infectious diseases don't sort of recognise country boundaries and can go anywhere. I think there's another dynamic we didn't have enough time to discuss here, which we also come into frequently in relation to some of the patient populations, which is that TB is quite a stigmatising illness, particularly within some cultural groups. And therefore, actually, you've got two separate things. One is when people are developing symptoms, is that those needs to be greater awareness for the population generally about those symptoms, seeing healthcare professionals and getting referred on for assessment, diagnosis and treatment. But secondly, as we get into trying to access populations for screening for latent disease, is actually there are groups of people who would feel that actually that somebody suggesting to them that they may be harbouring TB is a slur on them and their personality and everything else. And there's been a lot of good work done in London already, getting out into cultural groups, getting out through religious groups, and getting out into communities. And there is actually already within a lot of communities quite a good awareness that TB is a risk. What people don't know really at the moment is what to do about it. So I think you have to go out through all of those different routes, but the linchpin for that is all of your different local and community health services, so that when people raise questions about TB, they get the right answers. Because we still come, because the health community in its widest sense is not properly educated, we often get people who will say, well, I went to my GP and say, you know, what about TB? And they've got a response to that, actually, you know, well, I don't think it's that because you've not got a cough or something like that. You know, that's the sort of type of thing. So it's really a multi sort of coordinated approach all the way through.
Thank you. And you had a second question?
My second one, I'm working at Infant Haringey. I'm probably embarking on the journey you've been on in relation to consolidation. And my question is, having been there, what advice would you give to someone like us who's going there? Because closing anything these days, or at least attempting to, you have to have an inquiry, close an envelope, and someone talk to you about why did you do that? I'm being cynical. What lessons, what observations would you make to people who are embarking on doing exactly what you're doing for all the right reasons, better outcomes, etc.? We are wedded to and very emotional about buildings that really have outlived their use.
Yes, I mean, it's a really good point, and it wasn't easy, I suppose, is what I'll say. But the clinical evidence base is really important, and we had that validated by the National Clinical Advisory Team. So the clinical evidence, we wrote the clinical case, had that validated. The people are very attached to buildings, and I suppose it's just a matter of having lots of public meetings, lots of conversations with those people. And I suppose accepting the accusation that we had decided already, you know, and that which building it was going to be. We genuinely went out with a question of, we've got these four sites, which ones do you want to keep open? We said one, we think everyone, you know, would agree we have to keep open. It's our best building. We've invested most money in it. And then we genuinely asked the question on the others. And everyone, of course, preferred their own building. So the building that they've used. Even if it's not in the catchment area, you know, it doesn't matter. But so I think that we should be helpful to each other as organisations as well. So I think the other thing that we might be able to do as a neighbouring mental health trust is perhaps be helpful and perhaps present our story of what happened you know, what the outcomes are, what the evaluation is. We're about to do, hopefully, do a clinical trial as well on the sort of outcomes of our new system, really. So, you know, I think it's just presenting that research and the service user experience. I think we were they're probably underestimates. We were very cautious with those estimates, so they don't include any medical savings associated, of which there were. So, you know, clearly if you close hospitals you need to move the doctors somewhere, or you know, they're doing something different, and it may be that they went into the community and were actually doing more community work, so it might not have been a saving overall to the system. We had lots of really complex SLAs for estates and things like that, and so I'm not entirely sure what the savings are from those, and in fact we just didn't include them. So we've actually kept, in our overall QIP programme, we just kept that separate as estate savings. So, you know, yes, they've been delivered because we moved out of the buildings, and I delivered on the moving out of the buildings, but, you know, hey-ho, it's just deck chairs, really, if, you know, someone else can claim those savings. So, really, those are the pure savings from the reduction in staffing of those inpatient wards and a little bit of the rent where we were renting places, but... It's not really savings on medical, as I say, or estates.
But I think the question was focusing on whether there might be costs as a consequence of your change in service model.
Might have been, you know, conservatively calculated. And I'm saying, who is then, is there someone challenging when you look at, when you try to take credit for those savings? Is there someone else saying, like, well, in community, yes, you no longer have those patients, but now they're out in community, and these are the costs we're incurring?
Yeah. Yeah, the community had already benefited by increased investment. So I suppose that's, you know, so the trade-off was that actually they'd had the money already. They'd set up the crisis beds. They'd set up the crisis teams. So they've had that investment. The patients were... There was some duplication in the system, so they were using perhaps an inpatient bed and being under a community team and yes, I mean, it's difficult for people. They used to get a break when people came into hospital, and they don't get that break anymore. So.
Well, even, I guess, my question extends further to the future as commissioning environments change. You know, most communities are under block contracts, so, you know, when you try to follow streams of where the pool of money is being spent, and then as things shift out into the community,
yeah.
And those block contracts start falling away, and now commissioning groups have to look
can I sort of feed into this from a care of the elderly physician, and that you may be entirely right. This is about where you shuffle the chairs around and you just change the cost centre. But there is something about re-establishing people in communities when you've disestablished them from the community that's costly. And that's certainly true in elders, and I think it's certainly true in other chronic conditions. And that's a true saving. It's a morbidity saving, sometimes a mortality saving, I have to say, but certainly a morbidity saving. And that's where you do. But you're right. Otherwise, I mean, you get the deep suspicion you've just, you know, I've seen the data. I've seen people produce massive reductions in length of stay when actually all they did was they moved them to a community hospital. Yeah. Relabeled it as a local authority or private sector office, yeah. And said, aren't we marvellous? And they've not changed the morbidity of the patients. What you were sort of describing was getting in, you know, that sort of trying to create a system that might do that differently by maintaining and keeping their connections.
In part, what I'm trying to, I'm from a community,
yeah.
Healthcare area, so, you know, in part, what I'm just trying to do is kind of have everybody kind of reach
I suppose if I could just chip in, because of course we have, I mean, you're talking about shifting costs really, but because those, that all those services are under our management, so we know what our community services are actually costing us as well. So there hasn't been a cost shift because those services are funded, are there already within mental health, which is different from your community. And I think that it's about looking at those care pathways and the cost shifts. So, of course, we did have to put money into crisis beds, recovery centres, and so forth. You know, and luckily that probably happened just in advance of some of this sort of, you know, the bigger austerity measures.
Thanks for that. Question here.
Yeah. There's a sort of clarity of scale in terms of the system that you're reforming, but it strikes me that between the three of you, changes models. One is about full service reform, which would be mental health and TB, and one is much more an individual organisation's business model. And then the word commissioning came in at some point, and there was a word about bringing in commissioning. And so, to my mind, if someone is reforming their business and not reforming their services, then it's to a point no business of the commissioner as to how they run their organisation. But where you are reforming and bringing about savings, or where you are reforming you may need input and greater spending, because it's service reform, in theory, in this modern world, then commissioners should be involved. And so I guess the question for yourself is, were these savings realised by your organisation? So your organisation has nicely saved itself £5 million a year, but your commissioner is spending exactly the same as they ever did. For yourself, you want to sort of know where commissioners might be involved in the new world, but are they involved in the current world? Have they been involved in this sort of modelling that's taken place today? And I guess for the gentleman in the middle, did commissioners try and stick their oar in when you were trying to bring about your sort of organisational redesign?
The simple answer is the commissioners took £4 million out last year, and they're probably taking something like £4 million out this year. So they realised more costs than we delivered through doing this. So they were jointly publicly consulting with us on that, and they had to do that because it's actually their services.
So I understand partly what you're saying, but they're inextricably linked. So what the commissioners were, so the commissioners wanted deep sight to our plans because they were worried that we would not be able to provide the services, particularly when you dug that. So the overall figures for that is about 10.5 million coming out in a full year effect, net of redundancies. So they had a nervousness. So they were cited and they were interested, interestingly. Very much the stakeholder. And of course, partly we were there because of the changes in the system. Being an acute maternity hospital, an acute hospital, we didn't have the flexibility around the elective pathway to subsidise our business. To a certain extent, we've got to the leanest, I think, so not trying to call it up, but you know, we are in the top 14 hospitals in terms of the mortality ratio as measured, as now preferred by the Department of Health, top 9 for the Dr. Foster data, and by the University of York statistics, the most efficient hospital, because they were measuring acute pathway, and that's all we do. And we are lean and mean around it. So our commissioners were really interested in that because they didn't want us to fall over. They thought we were going to fall over, in fact. There were lots of people fall. And I'm not saying it's done now, because as part of a merger process, we're going through a bit of clinical due diligence. And it's quite clear that we are so lean at the moment that our governance processes are like that, which is leaving me a bit sleepless at night.
Bill? I'll come back to that, because I was going to ask you that question. as to how sleepless you were since it had come through. Yeah, I mean, there's been lots of commissioner engagement in the team plan. I think where the difficulty is actually going forward is very much, it was right at the end of the plenary session this morning, where it said, well, yes, we understand we need to invest this money, but we're moving into a world where there's no money going forward. And so I think that's the difficulty. So where we're taking this at the moment, we're actually meeting with cluster chief executives in London very, very shortly, getting engaged with the GP commissioning groups. And I think the difficulty in something like the TB programme, I've said, is I think on one side, the commissioners will be very happy to have in something like TB some of the guidelines, the benchmarks, the metrics that they've had in areas like cancer over the last few years, which makes it much clearer for different commissioning groups, what are they buying, what should they be buying, and if services are not coming up to those levels, what they don't want to buy. So that I think is won't be a problem getting solid commissioner buy-in. There already is commissioner buy-in. The more difficult thing, and I think this is a challenge for the whole of London commissioning going forward, is where we've got something where the case for doing something is so strong, but actually there's something that's not being done at the moment. So that's the screening for latent TB and treating latent TB. That's new. We don't do it at the moment. So therefore it's actually how do you then get this system going forward where you're going to be dealing with multiple commissioners in different areas and chunking up things in different ways, is how do you then get it approved to say this is one of the top priorities for us to put real cash into. And I think that's where we're going to struggle over the next bit of time because of it's difficult and because of the uncertainty, not because people aren't willing.
But you have got a targeted map. That's one of the, a bit like the world map, there's a targeted map. You could target Newham, you could target the two areas of East and North West London, and if you could prove it, because there's enough there to prove it, and then you're done for. So
I mean, if everyone was an argument for local commissioning,
Absolutely. But of course, don't forget there's an argument played out for that for HIV. There'd be an argument for all of those conditions that cost you money. They're all in those.
But they're not all as well.
No.
And don't forget, actually, conversely, the opposite also occurs, which is if you target it too locally, the people who've got that disease in the low prevalence areas get a really bad deal. So you get an inequity that occurs that way round. And that's why you do need for these conditions something which gives that overarching framework for the whole of London. But then it's actually implementation which is difficult.
Okay, so I'm going to have to call the session to a close because we've run a bit over time. I want to thank on your behalf the speakers. On behalf of the speakers, I want to thank you for coming. It was a small audience, but I think a really interesting and useful discussion. If you had a burning question, you didn't get a chance to ask it, I'm sure that the speakers don't mind you coming and asking that question now or over a cup of tea, which is now available. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from policyreview.tv. For more details, go to www.policyreview.tv. Please note that this audio is subject to copyright and cannot be used by other broadcasters or for commercial gain.